This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Do you say and do things when drinking that you regret the next day? Is alcohol a problem for you or someone you really care about? Over the next hour, we'll find out how people just like you and me found sobriety in AA through sharing their experience, strength and hope. Welcome to AA Live, brought to you by Alcoholics Anonymous.
Kia ora, e te whanau. Welcome to the AA Live radio show. This is a show and a podcast that explores the ideas behind a way of recovery through the Alcoholics Anonymous program. And my name is Sue, and thank you for tuning in and joining us from around the motu and the world this evening. Cool beans! That's a new one for me. I'm joining Mike and myself in the studio. I'd like to extend a wonderful welcome to our wonderful guest, Tanya. Hi.
Hello.
Thanks for taking the time to be with us today, Tanya.
You're welcome.
How's things been in your world?
Pretty good today. And
Come on, tell us, you've rescued a duckling.
Oh my goodness.
Come on. You've just been telling us about the rescue
mission. I live in a beautiful part of the world, and it's called Portobello, and on the Targo Peninsula. And of course, it's breeding season, and the ducklings and everything are coming out. And me and my mum were travelling to town today, and around the corner we went, and this lone little duckling, which was no bigger than my hand, smaller than my hand, was trying to get across the road. And it got across the road, and I went, wow, I've got to get this duckling. So I jammed on the brakes, took off over there, and it seen me, and it jumped into the tide, which was hellish. And the tide was really, really dodgy, and I thought, well, that's it. You're not going to see that duckling again. So I sort of had to go, and went to town and did our bits and pieces. And on the way back, I says to my mum, we're going to stop and just see if this duckling's there. And here it was, running around on the rocks on the foreshore. And I shot down there, tried to get it. The seagulls are circling at this stage because they want it, and it took off into the big rocks, which there's no way I could have moved. And I tried, I even talked like a duck, 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 quack, quack, and no, it wouldn't come out. So I went back up to the car, and I thought, oh, that's it. And I thought, no, I'll give it one more try. So I went back down, shot out from the rocks, and I just swooped and picked it up. And I took it back to my
little
mum.
Angel.
Yes, I am.
You are an angel.
I am. And so I took it home, and at the moment it's in a cage with Weet-Bix, water, and a wee blanket. And it'll just stay there until
it's got a little hottie and everything?
No, it's a duck.
Blanket?
No, it's a duck, Sue. It's a duck, Sue. It likes water. But it's safe. It's very safe. Yeah.
Oh, that's a great intro. We haven't had the duck intro before, have we?
No, AA saves lives.
Yes.
Right on. Right. Let's get started with the show. Alcoholics Anonymous is a service based on alcoholics helping other alcoholics. We do the work through our 12-step program. We're recovering alcoholics support each other who want to stop drinking, and where we learn how to live life. In the rooms of AA, by sharing and listening to the main theme of recovery by way of the AA program, each one of us has finally come to the realization that we are no longer able to handle alcohol. Somewhere along the line, our drinking behaviors have become toxic, and that we need others to help us realize that there is a way out of our alcoholic cul-de-sac. We do the mahi together and work through the 12 steps. And the most important thing is that we also realize that we don't try to deal with the problem single-handedly. We bring the problems out into the open with other alcoholics. Love that bit. Mm. For me, working the AA program is a daily practice that tests out what it means to be in recovery. Living sober 24 hours at a time allows me to be present and alert, plus to be here with you two awesome people and the duck story, and to talk through what it means to live a life of purpose and how we may handle difficulties or surprises that come our way.
So we start each meeting in the AA rooms by reading out the Alcoholics Anonymous preamble, which outlines the fundamental thrust of how our program works. Tanya, would you like to do the honours?
Thank you. AA preamble reads as, Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organisation or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Awesome. And just a disclaimer, what you hear tonight are the opinions of the three of us in tonight's show. So they're not necessarily the opinions of Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. We have guests who are invited to share their story and experience, so really it's just us, three recovering alcoholics, talking about different aspects of our own journey. And so another thing that we often do in meetings and in our spare time is read our daily reflection, which comes from a piece of literature that has a reflection for every day of the week. And so today's daily reflection for Tuesday the 11th of November is as follows. Self-acceptance. We know that God lovingly watches over us. We know that when we turn to him, all will be well with us here and hereafter. And that's from 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, page 105. I pray for the willingness to remember that I am a child of God, a divine soul in human form, and that my most basic and urgent life task is to accept, know, love and nurture myself. As I accept myself, I am accepting God's will. As I know and love myself, I am knowing and loving God. As I nurture myself, I am acting on God's guidance. I pray for the willingness to let go of my arrogant self-criticism and to praise God by humbly accepting and caring for myself. So it's quite a heavy-duty reading today.
Mm. It's a double A black battery.
Mm.
Or double D, whatever you want to say. How do you run with that, Mike? There's a lot of different interpretations.
Yeah. I think it's a. I guess like the God word is, you know, really open for interpretation in the room. So we each come to our own understanding of a higher power, and for lots of people, that's, you know, that can be a traditional God. But often it's something like the group itself, the group of drunks, or the program, or whatever you really want it to be. But I mean, I guess if you the first sort of interpretation that I worked with, because I kind of came in atheist, and I'm sort of curious now. I wouldn't describe myself as an atheist anymore, but certainly when I first came in, the group was something I latched onto because it was something I could see. You know, I could see people in a room, it was a group of people, and it was tangible. So I guess if you were looking at it through that lens, you could think that, you know, the group cares, you know, we care about each other as a group. And we know that when we turn to the group, you know, that we'll be helped out by the group, and the group's going to continue to be here for us. So yeah, there's ways you can kind of interpret this that, you know, can be a bit broader than a sort of straightforward reading. Mm. I don't know if that helps as a starting point.
I didn't have a when I came into AA, I didn't have a problem with the God word. Well, I wouldn't say I didn't have a problem. I have a higher power, universal spirit.
Mm.
That's what I use. But it's easier just to say God.
Mm,
God is just a word, you know. God, orderly direction, whatever you want to, you know. Mm. And as long as you can believe in something higher than yourself, whether it be God, whether it be whatever you want, that's what you use.
It's a power greater than
it's
yourself.
It's a power greater. I've got a sponsee that is definitely totally against God and trying to navigate her around using something else is I'm finding really challenging, but we're breaking. We're getting there, you know. Mm. Just trying to talk her into, you know, not talk her into it, but a goddess. Use what you know, whatever works for you.
Mm. And I think we've talked about this a little bit before, eh, Mike? But it's more like I used to over intellectualize it, you know, question what is it, what shape is it, and what's happening, what's happening. I need to know. And then it was just like, well, something's going to happen. I just keep coming to meetings. This is in my early sobriety.
Mm.
And then you get a bit more relaxed. And then you start to sort of open up your mind a bit. And, I just knew that this was one of the things I had. You know, you've got to sort of be open to it. And that's where you just could be willing to understand.
Willingness.
There's a wonderful energy open-minded. In the world. Mm. There's something, you know. The world is turning for a reason.
Mm.
You know, you can be really esoteric, right? Or you can be really, you know, more your spiritual power. is definitely more sort of aligned with a religion. Or
I think once you see your or feel your life changing, as I did, and seen other sponsees' lives change, there's too many things that happen in my life getting sober that I just totally believe it wasn't just me that's doing this. You know, there's got to be something out there bigger than me that leads me, directs me. And
through good times and the rough parts,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, I
agree with all of that.
Because at some point, you know, when Tanya, you've got many years of sobriety, but for me, it's like first when you sort of stop drinking, you start cleaning, you know, body's cleaning out, your brain's starting to sort of settle down a little bit, your anxiety's leaving. And so you feel calm. Maybe you're feeling calmer. Not always. Everyone, sometimes it takes a few years or months. It can take a week. I'm not quite sure. Everyone is different. But then, you know, there's unexplained things start to happen.
Absolutely.
And sure, that's a condition of, for me, it's just being calmer, but better at planning things, you know, like things are more aligned and not sort of piled on top of each other. So that's sort of the day-to-day things are sort of more easier. Mm. But, yeah, there's a sort of, serenity, that practice.
Serenity, yeah. It's just acceptance. Just accept that there's something bigger than you out there. And,
I really like the part in this reading where it talks about praying for the willingness to let go of my arrogant self-criticism. Because self-criticism, like I have now come to think that's sort of quite egocentric when you sort of, you know, all this sort of self-flagellation stuff. But but you wouldn't necessarily think about criticising yourself as being arrogant at first brush. But, so I liked that. I liked that part of the reading. That was good. I think we can spend lots of time beating ourselves up. I can spend time beating myself up. But often I'm taking myself, you know, too seriously when I'm doing so. So that's where I guess the arrogance slips in.
Oh, I definitely agree with that. I can still beat myself up. I can still do it. And, I can rip.
Well, like you should have, could have, those types of things.
Yeah. I should be this, I should be that, I could be doing that, I could be doing that, I'm useless, I'm this, I'm that. I can still do that after 27 years of sobriety. And then I've got to really pull myself up. And it's like, for me, it's by criticising myself, it's like I'm criticising God's work. And that's what my sponsor told me, and all my higher powers work. And I definitely can do it, not as much as I used to do it, but it's still there. I'm just more aware of it and can shut it down quicker.
You can, shutting down is a good word, handbrake it, change tact, all those kind of words.
Yep. Change the channel.
Catch the next train. I love the train idea. Yeah. Train comes in the station, don't want that train.
We'll go on the next one.
Get on the next train. Yeah, it's very much a sort of psychology type sort of thing, but yeah, that sort of works either way.
So there's nice stuff about acceptance and self-care and stuff in there as well. So there's lots going on there.
Should we play a track?
Should we crank into one
of Tanya's awesome selections? What have we got? What's up first?
Well, it's entirely up to the man of the day over there, I suppose.
Well, I think you've selected some songs for us.
I have.
We caught you on the fly here, mate.
No. I was born ready.
So what's the title of the track? Which one are we going to go for
first? I think we're going to go with your Lynyrd Skynyrd track.
Yeah, which was Free Bird. It's a beautiful track of Lynyrd Skynyrd, one of my favourite bands of the day. And if you sit back and listen to this awesome song, you'll love it.
Thank you. got to see.
Welcome back. That was Freebird by Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Big guitar solo going on there.
Big guitar solo. We cut that a little bit short.
We just sort of give it a wee nibble back.
Back to the business end of things. Anton, so thanks so much for joining us tonight. And, you know, one of the things that we love about having guests in is, you know, we get people to come and share their experience, strength and hope with us. So you would just really love to hear a bit about your story and what brought you to the rooms and how long you've been around and all of that sort of stuff. If you're happy to share your story with us.
Yep, cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
The stage is yours.
Again, my name's Tania and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Tania.
And my sobriety date is the 18th of the 8th of 1998, so 27 years ago. I got sober. I went to Queen Mary Hospital in Hamner Springs, but before I got there, I was brought up here in Dunedin, New Zealand, and I come from a long line of alcoholics on both sides of my family. My mum wasn't, and I'm often saying my dad was, but I'm wondering if actually he was or not. But he loved to drink, but I don't know if he was actually an alcoholic. And but I do know that when my dad did drink, he changed, and there was a lot of violence in my house, and he used to beat on my mum a lot, and me and my two brothers, I'm the youngest of three, and that was sort of how it was in our lives. And I grew up feeling really afraid, full of fear and anxious and...
Do you mean like that would just change on a dime, like the sort of mood and...
Well, I just...
Didn't know what was happening.
I just... It was never normal feeling, you know. Mm-hmm. I didn't fit in with my family. Well, I felt I didn't fit in with my family. They probably think differently. My peers, you know, at school, I sort of wanted to be like everyone else but didn't feel like everybody else. I kind of, you know, there was stupid things I would do. I remember at one stage I went to school and I cut all my eyebrows off and my eyelashes off. Well, why would a seven-year-old do that? But I did do that, you know, and I used to do silly things. And whether it was for attention, I don't know. I have no idea, but that's what I did. So just feeling, just alone, I suppose. And my dad and my mum used to argue a lot about... I remember my mum yelling when I was nine that girl needs a psychiatrist. I probably bloody did. I probably did, I mean. And because there would be a lot of fights about... my dad used to... I was his princess. And I think he used to play me and mum against each other a lot. But I didn't understand that at the time, you know. And so she wasn't a happy person with me. And when I was about 12 or 13, I think, I got drunk and it was on screwdriver and gimlet, I remember at the time. It was like syrup and it tasted disgusting, but I drank it and I also power chucked. But it took away those feelings of anxiety and fear, and I felt great. This feels great. I want more of this, and so I set out to get more of that. And back in those days, it wasn't hard, you know. Around Dunedin, I could go into my local pub when I was 11, 12, 13, and I kicked around with a lot of older people, and so I was sort of under their wing. And so I was, drinking in pubs when I was 13, 14. And no one sort of batted an eye back then, you know. I was in my school uniform sometimes and that I went to school. And got kicked out of both my high schools here in Dunedin. And that was sort of me. I got into a relationship when I was 13. And it was a relationship. I had my first child at 16, and The person I was with was very like my dad and used to beat on me a lot, and yet he was only 2 years older than me. And I had a baby girl, and by then even my drinking had escalated, and that's what I would think about the moment I opened my eyes in the morning was drink, and never even thinking that there's a problem here. I just thought I'm having a good time. I haven't got time to look after a baby. So she was promptly given to my mother, who was grateful, and I was never home. I was always out drinking with mates and stuff. Unfortunately for me, my drinking were usually blackout drinking, and I wouldn't remember where I'd been, what I'd done, or who I'd done it with a lot of the time. And that happened very regularly. And I'd wake up, in places that no little girl really should wake up, and with people that I certainly shouldn't be with. And, it was kind of like the people that I hung with was kind of like a ticking time bomb, Something's not going to be good coming out of this. And but anyhow, I kept drinking, and there was, like I said, there was lots of blackouts and lots of arguments in my family. I started stealing and to sell things to get money to drink. By this stage, the guy that I was with, we weren't together anymore, and I was with whoever wanted to be with me as long as they provided the drink, and I did that a lot. I'd go around pubs and, sit at the bar with my drink, and if someone come up and said, "Do you want a drink?" Yep. And if they supplied me the drink for the evening, they'd get supplied with other stuff. And that's how I lived, I didn't think there was anything too much wrong with that, but there was. And I had my second child when I was 20, and it was a wee boy, and I kept him with me, and loved him to bits, and but having my little boy didn't change my drinking. He would quite often be dropped off at my mum's place, and I'd be saying, at 10 o'clock in the morning, and I'll be back at 5 o'clock and arrive, 2 or 3 days later, and then ask her what her problem is. What's your problem, Mum?
Wow.
I'm allowed a life. And
did you have your younger daughter with you then?
No.
That was still sort of with your other, with your great
mum
support
had
of your
her.
Mum.
Yep. Yeah. And I used to get quite resentful about those sorts of things. And now I can think, thank God she was with my mother. Thank God, I think Mum wanted my boy as well, but my arrogance and that, and no way, you're having another one. You're not having another one of my kids, Well, she was thinking of the kids. She wasn't thinking of me. And but anyway, I had my boy, and when I was 22, I decided that if I moved away or did a geographical, my life would – I knew in my late 20s, I knew I had a problem with drink. Mm-hmm. I absolutely knew there was a problem with drink. But I wasn't ready, and I didn't think it was that bad that, I should stop drinking, I didn't know anything about recovery back then, it wasn't but I did know that before I left Dunedin to go to Nelson, where I ended up, I lived in a country town, and the days or the evenings that I was actually, my friend worked at a pub in Dunedin, actually, and every day I would ring her up and say, please, can you bring me some alcohol home? And she'd bring me, back in those days, she'd bring me half a dozen big bottles of DP in the brown paper bags, and I'd hide them behind the chair, and I'd just slowly drink it. And because if I wasn't drinking, I felt scared, I felt fear, I felt anxiety, I felt not part of, and I'd rather die than feel like that. And the only thing that could take those feelings away was the alcohol. And I didn't realise that the actual alcohol was fueling the feelings, I didn't know anything about those things. And anyhow, so I would go to the, I'd got a knock on my country doctor's door at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning. Please give me something to take the edge off, which he did. And they were like little egg shaped, but I think they were Valium, and I'd pile them back just to take away those feelings, you know. He said to me one time, many years ago, he says, I think you've got a problem with drinking. And I remember saying to him, and I think that's the last time I'm going to see you, you know. You know, to tell me, just help me, you know. Give me the drugs, give me the whatever you can give me just to take the edge away. But he was right. And anyhow, I moved to Nelson when I think I was 22. My son was 2, I think. I actually went up there and chased a guy up there. Got up there, ditched the guy and just stayed. And I moved to a little country town called Tapawera, which is about 50 k's inland from Nelson. And it was a forestry village, and it was full of alcoholics. And the Kahatu pub was there. And boy, did I have some fun. And it just escalated, the drinking, the...
So this is a whole bunch of like forestry workers.
Oh,
like,
yeah. It's just like, it was a forestry village. There was families upon families there, you know. Yeah. And, you know, and I was the new girl there, you know. And, you know, I met up with another guy and we actually moved in together. And but it was fueled with alcohol and drugs. And, you know, the whole, our wee street was called the Bronx. And every night there were kegs, casks of wine. Always women getting beaten, you know, it was just, that's what it was. And everyone just got drunk and had a merry old time. Well, I thought it was a merry old time, but I think the difference with a lot of them was that they would, once the keg was finished and whatever, they'd all go back to their homes and go to bed, and I'm still looking for more alcohol at 3-4 o'clock in the morning by myself walking around the street.
That obsession. That big word.
And because I couldn't find any, again, the fear and the anxiety starting to sneak back in, and I can't sleep, I can't eat, I can't do anything. I'm actually frozen with panic attacks, and it was scary. And I'd be up all night. I'd have to get my boy off to school, and I'm shaking, absolutely shaking. And, you know, it was just a crazy way to live. And anyhow, I had another son when I was 27, and, you know, I drank through that pregnancy, and I thank God that he was okay. And it was just escalating, you know. There was just nothing, and no one could stop me drinking. You know, casks of wine every day, home brew. We'd make home brew, and we'd have it all nicely stacked in the cupboard above us, and think, you know, it stays there for 6 weeks. It was gone in 3. You know, I'd just zoom through it, sediment and all. I don't care, as long as it did the job. And there was a lot of arguing, and I mean, my partner was a drinker, and but he didn't drink the way I drank, you know. And I got talked about, you know. I used to think that I was the life of the party and everyone's laughing, but they're actually, a lot of them were just laughing at me and my antics, and being cross-eyed and falling asleep on the ground, and, you know, just crazy, crazy stuff. And bringing my mum up in the middle of the night and abusing her and not remembering, and ringing overseas and not remembering ringing overseas, and I'd get all these $500 bills coming in. And my,
so that's the full blackout in action,
just,
isn't it?
Oh, yeah. You know, waking up in someone else's bed.
Streaming with
someone else.
Every day, yeah.
You know, it was just constant. And then you had the shame and the guilt and those feelings of, oh my God, what have I done? You know, again, I've done it again, you know. And you would think that when you're like that, you'd think, hey, this is a real problem and I need to stop, I need to get help. But I didn't. I just continually do it, you know. And so every day it was the shame and the guilt and all those feelings just to go and do it all again. That obsession, you know, I wake up in the morning, the first thought is, when am I going to get some alcohol, and how am I going to get that alcohol? Because I need to get pissed. It's as simple as that. I need to get drunk, and so I don't have to feel. I don't have to do anything, you know. And anyhow, it happened that my youngest son, I think he was, when he got to about, my oldest boy by that stage was 14, and my youngest was 7, and, you know, they were fed, they were loved, they went to school, but they still didn't really have a present mother, you know. I did all the basic stuff, you know, and but still, you know, that alcohol came first before anything else in my life. And, you know, my daughter was still in Dunedin with my mother, and I was still mum to her, and that was grandma. And, yeah, it was just a crazy way to live. And then my oldest son, when he was 14, I was outside, I remember that, and I was lying on the concrete outside, and he came out and says to me, "Mum, if you don't stop drinking, I'm beep out of here." Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, you know, I still kept drinking that night. I remember that, and I must have gone to bed. And the next morning, it was the weirdest thing. The next morning, I was sitting there, and I must have got the boys to school, and the phone rang, and it was this doctor, who I didn't know who this doctor was. He was a locum at the local doctor's place, and he rang up about my youngest boy's bedwetting. And I remember sitting there, and I blurted out, "Look, I've got a drinking problem. I don't know what to do. I'm scared, and I don't know what to do." And he says to me, "You come and see me right now." So I remember getting in my car, driving 20 minutes to see this doctor, and he had me in his rooms for about an hour. And amazing man. And he was telling me about Hamner, Queen Mary Hospital in Hamner. Would you like to go? And I just went, yep, let's do it. And
what was the length of time before that conversation to when you were?
It was 7 days.
Seven days?
He had me in 7 days. And he says to me, I remember him saying to me, "Look, if you need or feel you need to drink until you go into the hospital, you do that." But I didn't. There was something that happened.
Just a switch, sort of.
There was something that happened that day. And I do remember sitting on that chair before I went up to see him and just, I don't know who I was talking to. I just remember saying, I need help. I don't know what to do. Please, whatever. Just help me. Something happened. I can't explain that, but something happened that day. And I never drank. I sorted my kids out with my mum and that. And I went to Hamner for 8 weeks or whatever, and you know, that was the turning point in my life. I didn't know before that about recovery. I didn't know about AA. I thought in my head, I'm the only one in this whole world that feels like this.
Yeah.
I am so alone. I'm the only person that feels like this. I can't talk to anybody. No one will listen, and they all just think I'm a freak. And when I spoke to that doctor, he just changed it. And I did go to Queen Mary. And
so it was the beginning of your...
It was the beginning of my recovery.
Right, 27 years ago.
27 years ago, you know.
Wow.
And I thought that when I went in there is I just need to stop drinking and my life would improve and everything would be all right. Nah, you know. I had other behaviours, character defects that had to be looked at, and so they took a lot longer to tidy up, I suppose, and I did that through the steps and having my sponsors. When I got out of Hamner, the first thing I did was go to a meeting that night, and I was so scared. It was my first AA meeting. I was so scared. This lady came up to me and she said, "Would you like me to be your sponsor?"
How about that, hey?
And she's still my sponsor today.
Wow.
27 years.
Amazing.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah, she's still my sponsor. She's my best mate.
Well, that's so cool.
Oh, my gosh.
And she still lives in Nelson. I'm back in Dunedin, 3 years in Dunedin, and we catch up FaceTime once a week and for about 2 hours. And I drop everything on her and she'll drop everything on me, and then we'll have a laugh and talk about gardening or whatever, and talk to you next week. And but if I need her at any time, she's right at the end of the phone. Yeah, and gorgeous woman. I think she's got 40 years sobriety. And anyhow, I I got out and I started my recovery. I started my recovery, but there was a whole big mess around me that I had created before coming into recovery. You know, my first amends was to my eldest son. And
who picked you off the
who got me off the ground pavement. Yeah,
and off the concrete.
Yeah, he did. And yeah. My mum, I had to make so many amends, and being in the program and doing the steps and having a sponsor, and it repaired the damage and that I had caused through drinking alcohol. And I often share about this. I often share about this.
That's okay. Yeah.
Because it's my story. And
it's time of the year as well, isn't it? Yeah.
You know, my boy, my eldest boy, that says, you know, if you don't stop drinking, Mum. Well, he died when he was 20. And he was an alcoholic drug addict. And it's coming up to his anniversary in 4 weeks on the 28th of November. And I get a bit weepy around this time. But, he died. And there was nothing I could do about that. And I tell you what, that serenity prayer, accept the things I cannot change, courage to change them, that was said a lot. And, it was a crazy time. I was 7 years sober when that happened, and it was a crazy time. And but through AA, through doing the steps and having my sponsor and actually being cocooned by my AA family in Nelson, they loved me back to wellness.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And I didn't have to drink because my boy died, you know. He died. And no amount of drink was ever going to change that, bring him back, or make me feel better, you know. And I had to keep that really, really forefront in my mind that that is not going to help. And so I didn't drink. And I remember when we brought him home from the Undertakers, and he stayed at home for a few days, and we brought him in, laid him out in the lounge, and I says, "G'day, Chris, how's it going?" And I jumped in my car and I went to a meeting. That was my priority, is to get to that meeting, and that's what I did. I've had relationships in sobriety that haven't lasted, and I've done things in sobriety that perhaps I shouldn't do. But I tell you that through doing things that I shouldn't do in sobriety, I've learnt. Mm. I feel that feelings, you know, that emptiness, that shame. You know,
You're not covering up.
I'm not perfect. You know, I'm not a perfect person. Yeah. And we still muck up, you know. And what did I say? It's progress rather than perfection. Well, I'm progress because I'm certainly not perfect. What is perfect? I don't know what perfect is, and don't want to be perfect. And today, I live in a caravan on the Otago Peninsula, just not far from my mum, who's 91, and she's not an alcoholic, but she's a hoarder. Oh, is she a hoarder? And that's okay. And I hang out with her. My daughter, who I gave to my mother, is 45, and she's married with my three beautiful granddaughters. And we're as close can
it's
be.
It's unbelievable. So cool. And do you see them on a regular basis?
All the time. I'm going there after this for tea. And,
I love it. I mean, from this, you know, I've heard your story before, and because of, you know, at our AA meetings, and, it's just so, it's tough, but there's that sort of exposure, that vulnerability, you know, and like in your rawest moment. And that gives me a lot of hope in my life, is because I know that, you know, I'm going to be going through those things in sobriety, and to know that, that I can I can have that support and that unconditional love to, you know, to your close friends and your people.
Well, I give it back to my sponsees now.
Oh, you sure do.
You know, I've got three sponsees down here and I'm taking them through the steps. And we've all got our own stories. And no one is better than the other one. And it's not even about that. Mm. It's just our stories, you
know.
It's
not a challenge, is it?
No, it's not.
It's not like, hey, you know? My one's way worse than that one. Or my one's not as good as that one. Or maybe not as good as that one.
Yeah, I haven't done that yet. But I look at my son who died, you know, and when he was 14 and he was already on his journey, you know. And I had, as a mother, had to watch that. And I used to say to him when he was about, he was a fisherman. And so he fished with the big boys. He was an inshore fisherman. So a lot of the guys he got round with him a lot older than him as well. And I remember when he was 15 or 16, I can't remember, and he was in Wellington. And he rang me up at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, he goes, hey, Mum, what are you up to? I said, well, I'm asleep actually, Chris. I said, where are you? He said, oh, I'm in a strip joint. And I'm thinking, oh, golly, no. And he was absolutely drunk. And all I could do was pray for him, you know, and I tried to get him to recovery. Come to a meeting. No, I'm not ready for that sort of stuff. Da, 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 da. And I says, okay. But, you know, I cried buckets of tears over that boy before he died. I did. I cried buckets because I could see the road he was going down, you know. And I believe God had other plans for him. Mm. I do, and as a mother, I kind of always knew I'd outlive that boy, and that's okay as well, you know. It's just, I don't know, it's a knowing, I don't know.
And their core, that sort of profound knowledge,
that mother,
you think?
And it's okay as well, you know. I believe where he is, he's in a good place. And, you know, and I've got my younger son, Sam. He lives in Sydney, and he's 34, and I'm off to Sydney to see him for Christmas. He shouted me a ticket to go and stay with him.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yep, and so I'm looking forward to that. For me today, I can moan about my life at times, as I do, and, you know, I wish I had this, I had that, but you know what? It doesn't matter. I've got a good life today. I'm a grateful alcoholic. I see people around me coming into the rooms, newcomers, and I just think, you know, this is your start of your journey, and it's hard. And but that's what I do today, you know.
There's patience and then there's firmness.
Oh, yeah.
Like that, hey?
Yeah. 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 You know, with my sponsees, you know, you do the steps, you do the suggestions. If you don't, you know, it's suggested only. If you don't want to, you don't have to. But, you know, one of my sponsors says to me, you're a bit hard. I went, no, I'm not. I'm actually take off from my sponsor, you know, and I want to see recovery. I want to see you get well. And and AA works. AA works when nothing else can work, you know. But in saying that, other people can find other ways of getting sober and staying sober. Mm-hmm. I couldn't do that. I can't do that. I firmly believe that AA is for me. It's where I belong. I love my meetings, and I love the people in AA.
And you throw a great meeting on Thursday nights, don't you?
Yeah, the Thursday night serenity.
That meeting. It's so unique, and the environment that you create.
Yeah, it's like a lounge.
It is a lounge vibe, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's really cool.
Candles going and lamps going, and it's just like a big lounge, you know, and we have lollies and we have all sorts of things going on. But that's my life today, and it will be until my last breath, you know, God willing. God willing, I will stay sober. And, you know, all I can say is that, you know, AA works. AA works. And if you're listening and you're new, yeah.
Keep on coming back.
Keep on coming back.
Baby.
Hey, that's such a, you know, amazing, powerful story. Thanks so much for sharing and being vulnerable and, you know, sharing that with everyone. I think that's the kind of cool thing. I think you kind of alluded to it before, but, you know, sometimes by sharing our mess, we can help other people, which is kind of, is nice. It kind of seems like it makes the mess make sense a bit or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Should we play, how's our timing going? Should we play a little track? Or what do you think? I really want to hear one more of Tanya's selected pieces.
Yeah, we've probably got time for one of the two.
No more tears.
Yep, we're going to go with some Ozzy Osbourne. Rest in peace. No more tears. Awesome. Well, that's all we've got time for tonight. So just really like to thank you once again, Tanya. Thanks so much for coming in and sharing your story. It's been really awesome spending some time with you and getting to know you a little bit.
Yeah, you're welcome. Really, really appreciate it. It's been lovely sitting across from you, listening to your story. Yeah,
thank
it's
you.
Amazing.
Really powerful.
Yeah.
So, and just to let you all know out there that if you feel like you might want to reach out to us at all, there's two ways you can contact Alcoholics Anonymous. You can call us on 0800 229 6757, 24 hours a day, I believe. There's somebody at the other end of that phone line.
That's right.
So, you know, please reach out if you think that, you know, you want some help. And there's also the New Zealand AA website, which is aa.org.nz. It's worth having a look at. It's got a big list of meetings. There's both online meetings and in-person meetings all around the country. So yeah, if you have any queries or questions about our show, then you can drop us an email at aalive@aaotago.org.nz. And you can also listen to the show again if you missed parts of our conversation this coming Sunday night from 8:30 p.m. You can also download the show from the ORE FM website. So that's
Wait, there's more. It's like added extras, right? It's right. You get some fries with it and like a mini Coca-Cola or something.
A mini one? Why not a large one?
Why yeah, not a jump? You know, I just came out. It's a stream of consciousness. I'm sorry.
No, that's good. Hey, that's all we've got time for tonight. So, yeah, take care, everyone out there. And until next time, matewa.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good night.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.